Thanks. Good afternoon and welcome to the final session before lunch. We've got a very good lunch coming up, so we look forward to that after our session. We're going to move from looking at incentives and remuneration to looking at training and education and how this can be utilised to reinforce ethics and standards in companies. I'm going to break the mould slightly in that I am going to use PowerPoint, but you're pleased to know that I'm only going to use one PowerPoint. So, as I say, my name is Colin Morrison. I'm the Deputy Chief Executive and Director of Education at Charter Banker Institute, and I'm very much looking forward to working on this session. If I might, just a few words about the Charter Banker Institute, who we are and what we do. We are the oldest institute of bankers in the world, having been founded in 1875. The Charter Banker Institute has the unique right granted by the Privy Council through our charter to award the Charter Banker designations to individuals who meet our educational and professional standards requirements. The Institute is the leading professional body for retail and commercial bankers in the UK, with over 30,000 members currently. And in 2015, more than 12,000 new students enrolled with the Institute. And this influx has led, for the first time in our history, for us to have a majority of female members amongst our membership. We are a not-for-profit body governed by a council of members drawn from the banks and the banking profession. The aim of our Institute is very much to enhance and sustain professionalism in banking, working with banks and bankers to raise pride in our colleagues' professionalism and contribute to rebuilding trustworthiness in our banks, bankers and the banking system. Our work also supports the work of regulators and banks to enhance and sustain the culture of customer-focused ethical professionalism in banking. And in 2011, we established the Charter Banker Professional Standards Board, and we're going to hear more about that just in a few moments' time. So I'm delighted to welcome our three speakers for the session. We've got Katie Ball, first of all, who's Acting Head of Professional Standards for the Charter Banker Professional Standards Board. And previously, Katie worked for RBS for over 25 years. We've got Michael Romer, who is Group Head of Compliance at Barclays Bank. Mike has been with Barclays since 2012 and previously worked at Citigroup and JP Morgan. Welcome. And finally, we'll be hearing from Dr. Javi Marcos, who's Director of Custom Programmes and Senior Teaching Faculty at Cambridge Business School. Welcome. And before joining Cambridge, Judge Dr. Marcos was at Cranfield, and he also worked with Unilever as well. So the plan for the session is that I will ask all three speakers to give a very short presentation on the theme, and then we'll have an open session and invite questions of our speakers from the floor. I've particularly asked our speakers in this session to focus from their viewpoints on how professional education and training can support banks, bankers, regulators and customers in a world where we've seen increased risks, increased volatility and indeed growing regulatory requirements. So I will hand over to Katie.
Balls. Balls of professionalism, that is. I know it's nearly lunchtime and I guess you're getting hungry. I know I am as well. So I wanted to get your attention. It's also a bit of a cheeky reference to my surname, but it's also mainly a reference to the courage that I think we need in these uncertain times. I'm really happy to be here today to talk about how training and education can help towards pride, professionalism, trust and culture. You'll be glad to know as well, it's not death by PowerPoint for me either. I just have the one slide. And if you remember one thing about what I have to say, it's about my balls of professionalism. I believe there are three ways in which an individual can demonstrate professionalism. The first is professional standards, which I will come back to. In the middle, we have professional membership. And by that I mean of a professional body or institute, and perhaps that's combined with continuous professional development, or CPD. And to the right, we have professional qualifications. Now, we all know what they are. That's actually generally a way of looking at someone's knowledge at a moment in time. It may be revalidated with some CPD, but generally, It's that moment in time. How that differs from a professional standard, in that a professional standard also looks at the expertise, that knowledge that an individual has, but it also considers conduct. And by that, I mean an individual's values, attitudes, and behaviour. Professional standards are also revalidated annually, and we know that's an approach that the regulators really like. So, why am I here? What is the Chartered Bank Professional Standards Board? We've heard it's a bit of a cluttered landscape, but the CBPSB, it's a joint voluntary initiative. It's set up between 10 member banks, Barclays being one of them, Mike, and the Chartered Banker Institute. I know a number of our member firms represented here today as well. It was set up in 2011, so we're coming up for our fifth anniversary, and it covers 70% of the UK banking workforce. It's predominantly a UK-based initiative, but some of our member firms have chosen to roll out the standards globally, and that's great, that's absolutely fine. But we're unique in that we are the only body looking at the development and implementation of professional standards for individual bankers. As part of our CBPSB aims, our unique purpose is to enhance customer confidence in every banker, in every UK bank. Events over the last few weeks with Brexit, sorry, I have mentioned it, I believe this means it's now more important than ever. In uncertain times, it's easy to raise up those drawbridges, but I believe now is not the time to start thinking about slashing an education and training budget, where those budgets, they impact trust and professionalism and pride. I believe the work of the Chartered Banker Institute and the CBPSB can be a safe haven in these stormy times. And we've got training already in place that can help. Now, I know we've got a very diverse audience today, so I'm going to speak briefly about this from four viewpoints. For banks, for individual bankers, for the regulators, and perhaps most importantly, from our customers' perspective. If I consider banks first, CBPSB professional standards and the work of the Institute can help banks and bankers enhance and sustain a culture of professionalism. By that, they can restore trust. And standards can help banks meet and exceed the new regulatory requirements. So with our professional standards, the banks themselves determine their own method and population for implementing them. And in many cases, this might be linked to their existing systems and processes. But what we do, we go out and we partner with the banks and we benchmark those systems and processes against a defined set of requirements, covering both conduct and expertise. We also revised our code recently to align its points to the five individual conduct rules, but actually our code of professional conduct goes above and beyond that, and our member firms all subscribe or adopt to that code too. For banks, in what other ways can education help? Well, the Institute's new Certified Bank Director programme, set up with the Irish Institute of Banking, can help. And the big question, are your staff fit and proper? We know the onus is on the banks themselves to assess and show this. The Institute can help. For example, there's a new initiative that's set up between the Institute and the Chartered Institute of Securities and Investment that can provide certificates of professionalism that can help. And standards can also help banks get the most from the apprenticeship levy. Moving to the individual, we know that professional standards and professional qualifications, either through the Institute or another professional body, can be a real source of pride. Pride for individual bankers, as well as for banks themselves, has been severely eroded in recent years. And our research shows that we are starting to see the evidence of increased pride, but that progress is fairly slow and very steady. The Institute's also been working with Leeds University to develop an enhanced ethics and integrity test for members. So moving to the regulator, I've already mentioned the alignment of our code with the individual conduct rules. I do want to talk about the standards themselves. The foundation standard for professional bankers, which is at a fairly basic level, but it has been achieved in 2015 by almost 250,000 individual bankers. I'm sure you'll agree that's a tremendous achievement. That standard has been very much aligned to the individual conduct rules. For more senior leaders, there's a leadership standard, and that is aligned to elements of the senior managers regime. We talked about fit and proper. We're also looking at the middle ground and what professional standard might fit into that space to help with the certification regime. Please do come and chat to me afterwards if you'd like to know any more detail about this. So I'm excited about our opportunities to help our banks demonstrate those requirements to the regulators in really practical ways. So finally, the customer, last but not least, as they say. We do work annually with YouGov, and we conduct surveys. We ask questions of MPs, other opinion formers, adults and bank employees themselves to see what the levels of pride are like, is there an increase, and also awareness of our work. And there's also a customer-focused advisory panel, and that consists of consumer groups, business leaders, and other professional institutes to give a different viewpoint. And we're actually widening that out to be a wider stakeholder forum, so we actually really do get a broad end-user perspective for our work. So finally, back to my balls. Hopefully you'll know now, those are the three ways that I believe education and training can link to professionalism, pride and trust. And the events of the last weeks have shown that education is needed, I believe, now more than ever. I believe now is the time for courage.
Thanks, Kitty. Interesting. Mike?
Okay. So my name is Mike Romer. I'm the compliance chief for Barclays. I'm going to take a slightly different approach than Katie, but you did get my attention, right? So a couple of quick things, right? I'd encourage you to read an article called Those Ethics Trainings Your Job Requires Are Even Dumber Than You Think, right? It's written by someone named L.V. Anderson for Slate Magazine. And it talks about the limitations. So Barclays has been on a culture and values and behaviors journey and program since the LIBOR events of 2012. It started with training for 140,000 employees face-to-face. We created 1,000 champions of culture and values. Those champions were kind of trained extensively, and then they became the impetus for us to spread kind of the word around the organization. That was the starting place. What we've discovered is over time that no one kind of training works, no one individual setup. I would tell you that e-learning is probably the most useless, I find, and we've found, driven primarily by it tends to be easily measurable. Examples are the Department of Justice that we have some experience with and others do as well, are very much focused on who takes the training. And how do you demonstrate training success? And in many e-learning situations, it's driven by the number of people who take it as well as how they did on a rudimentary understanding of the facts. Now we've taken feedback we've gotten on e-learning and we've enhanced it. So now we use, as an example, very quick to the point cartoons for branch staff so they can very quickly understand what the key aspects are for e-learning. The other thing we do is we look at a host of different kinds of trainings, and it has to be integrated with an overall program of culture and values in an organization. It is just one aspect, and it will not necessarily drive ethics and standards, but it will certainly enhance things that you've done throughout the organization. One of the other aspects that we've been very successful with is tone at the top, And we're very much focused on the outcomes of the training, not the specific training itself. So what kind of behavioral changes do we notice? How do we measure those? They become quite a bit more important. There are probably a couple of different things that add to or can stop the training from working. Management buy-in is one. Multiple approaches and methods is what I talked about. The employee life cycle, we built it into the employee life cycle. So now when people come on board, we ran the whole organization through that 140,000 kind of values and behaviors training. Now it's built into onboarding of folks. It's built into our how we hire folks. It's built into, like the last panel, how individuals get compensated, rewarded, what kind of assignments they get, how is their incentive structured, all connected to a life cycle of ethics and standards and behavior. We also do credibility and enforcement enhances it. So how do you deal with bad standards and conduct? How quickly and how swiftly and how openly do you do that? And then obviously measurement. We use surveys like YouGov and we use others like Net Promoter Scores. But we also actually look at results. We do some testing and poking around on it. I guess the last thing I'd say, and we can do a lot more during Q&A, is that we've built a program over time at the organization that we think is embracing innovation. One of the things we've done is we've created a partnership with, in fact, Cambridge, and we've rolled out a compliance academy across the organization that's very much focused on behavioral science, leadership, communication, and influencing, as opposed to technical compliance training. We've also come up with a Barclays Lens training now, which virtually every person in the organization goes through, and it's very much around ask these five questions when you're doing business. Any business, any decision you're doing, kind of use the lens, which is how are we making profit, and is it the right thing to do? And are we being transparent with our customer as our starting point and the other constituents that Katie mentioned, the regulators, our shareholders in the business? So we use all that lens training, and then we do rotational programs in and out of the organization. All of these things are kind of an ecosystem of training and development that's designed to influence behavior and yield good outcomes. As opposed to historically, we haven't gotten good results with very traditional training, but we think there is a place for it, but it has to be a part of the whole ecosystem. So I'll stop there.
Javi?
Thank you. Delighted to be here today. Following on Mike's, I'd like to address the question, how can training and learning help firms enhance its ethics and standards? And I'd like to bring two ideas. One is actually an example of the work that we've been doing with Barclays, the Compliance Career Academy, for the last 3 years, and to propose a very simple framework that I believe underpins the effectiveness of learning and education interventions, which essentially, in my view, has to address cognitive, behavioral, and social elements of learning. Just to make sure that I make the right assumption here. How many of you believe that training and education are interchangeable? In other words, conceptually very close concepts. How many of you believe that training and education are distinct? Right, I'm going to take the second approach. I'm going to argue that training is very effective to raise standards, but you really need education to raise ethics within a firm. I typically see training as focused on a particular topic, whilst education tends to be holistic. For instance, the work that we've been doing with Barclays in the Compliance Academy actually takes a very wide view of compliance, risk. For instance, we run a program that has a foundational modules that start with a module on what is compliance, then moves into products and services, global financial services, and understanding the regulatory environment. And that is one core element of this program. The second one, advanced modules, look at things like behaviors and practice, conduct risk, financial crime, and what's compliance in international environments. So we believe that education has to have a holistic view if it is really to become effective in raising ethical levels. The second one, when you look at training, it typically takes one approach, one discipline. It may be legal, it may be financial. The work that we promote in educational interventions is actually grounded in psychological insights, is grounded in finance, is grounded in organizational behavior, is grounded in economics. All these disciplines together have the potential to bring about, you know, transformation and a real shift in the way people think and in the way people behave. Also, you know, exploring the dichotomy between training and education, I would define training as discrete interventions that are, you know, very often, you know, bounded in time. The work we're doing, you know, takes participants through a two-year period. And if you think about, in order to shift cognitive structures, you actually need to give people time. Not just time to learn, but also time to apply that learning to practice, and then to reflect on that practice and bring that, you know, back into the learning. Therefore, those of you who may be considering interventions that are effective in raising ethical standards may need to consider, you know, the investment in time that participants require. Thinking in terms of training, traditional approaches to training, you know, tend to develop new knowledge, develop, you know, new thinking in terms of how people think. I believe that education brings, you know, three different aspects that I just, you know, mentioned that I will go back to in a second. And the last one, you can run a training intervention regardless of the company, you know, regardless of the culture. We strongly believe that educational interventions have to be tightly linked to the particular culture of the organization. And that's why, you know, in the work that we've been doing, you know, we actually blend the academic expertise with Barclays, you know, on-the-ground professional expertise. These two, the academic, you know, the generalizable insights, together with the specific and expertise in particular local context, is the one that makes the difference. So, essentially, I have argued that, you know, training and education are different. I believe that these need to be underpinned by strong designs. And the last thing I'd like to propose is that when looking at effective training and education interventions, one has to consider these three elements, the cognitive, the behavioral, as well as the social elements of learning. Cognitive, you know, we all know that, you know, knowing about something will unlikely, you know, change the way we operate. So, for instance, what we place a special emphasis in our programs is in ensuring that individuals couple self-awareness with situational awareness. And, you know, we make reference to, you know, how, for instance, physical phenomenon or emotional phenomenon may have an influence in how people make decisions, the extent to which they are prone to take, you know, calculated risks. And these are, you know, elements that underpin the next element, which is behavioral change. People tend to have, you know, a process, and they start thinking differently before they start acting differently. And we see these two as, you know, mutually reinforcing. And that is all fine in the learning setting. Our question is, how do individuals, you know, then, you know, show, you know, that behavioral change back in the workplace? And that's where you have to start, or you need to start taking a holistic approach, almost like a network or ecosystem approach. Individuals will behave differently based on what they think, based on their premises, but also based on the context in which they operate. In other words, you have to intervene beyond the individual and look at the social context in which they operate. Because you may have individuals acting and behaving differently in two different contexts depending on who they work with. So that's, you know, something I would like to, you know, to bring, you know, as a point to consider, that effective training and educational interventions that raise standards and the ethics of a firm actually have to have these three components, the cognitive, the social, and the behavioral.
Thank you. So we've had three perspectives there. We've had Katie talking about professional bodies and standards, Mike talking about what they do in Barclays, and obviously the academic standpoint as well. I'd like to open it up to questions. Do we have the roving mic? Any questions? We've got one down here.
Thank you. Do you think it's a good idea to actually do cultural training rather than just embedding culture in everything else that you do? Because once you start making it explicit, you are going to be trained for your culture. You're sending a particular kind of message to the employee, which might say, actually, we really don't think you're good enough, but we're going to try and knock you into shape to make you good enough, rather than just making the whole organisation be knocked into shape rather than the individual staff members? Oh, Stephen Murgatroyd.
So the question there was, is it a good idea to train for culture? I think sums it up.
Sure, I'll give it a go. The training that we've rolled out isn't called cultural training. We're using that here. Interestingly, all of our regulators want to know how we measure culture, and they will all assess us against our culture. And that's in the press and everywhere. So the company is used to hearing about it. Inside the firm, it started as values and behaviors training. We created a conduct college in some of our front office businesses and our middle office. And it was a very easy story to tell when we kicked it off, because we were being vilified in the press and everywhere else in the world for LIBOR. And our fines total, you know, if we add up our fines, ultimately the firm hasn't made any money in the last several years. So it's a very easy business person's assessment of we need to get better at how this works. It's very much focused, so it's evolved into focus. It's now part of onboarding. So it has evolved very much in line with your question and your suggestion. It evolves into the employee life cycle, different jobs they take. We create curriculum for people in different positions in the organization. Those training sessions include different aspects of our values and behaviors. The Barclays Lens training asks the five questions. There was a debate about calling it conduct or something else, but it is, in fact, the way we want people to bias all their decision-making process with a customer focus on virtually everything they do. So I agree with the premise. If it's a separate thing, over time, it loses any sort of... That goes back to some of these my comments on e-learning, right? When you get the competition law e-learning session, right? And it takes an hour to do the competition law e-learning session. People switch off. It's a function of going through the motions as opposed to making it part of how, you know, who you are and how you do business. So I agree with that premise. And I think over time, we've gotten better at it, but we can always do a better job.
Have you?
I would like to add that I see training as a necessary but not sufficient condition. And I tend to revert to the classics. You know, when it comes to organizational culture, what do we mean? I believe that organizational culture in the following change work is about artifacts, beliefs, and take it for granted assumptions. And training is a powerful artifact to create language, to legitimize, you know, certain behaviors. But you've got to go beyond. You've got to address the fundamental beliefs and the taking for granted assumptions in order to bring about renewed culture.
And certainly from my perspective, when we go out and we work with the member firms to actually look at the elements they have from their systems and processes that meet the elements of the standard, I think it's a bit more subtle than that. I don't think anybody overtly goes out and waves a flag saying, today we're doing culture training. But certainly I've seen examples, and I can obviously use the Barclays Lens because Mike's mentioned that. I've seen similar things across other member firms. I've seen lots of good examples of storytelling being used, case studies, scenarios and scenario planning. So it's not actually, from my perspective, I've not seen it where people say, today we're doing culture training, this is it. But it does tend to be woven in to a lot of the things that we look at. A bit more subtle.
Thanks.
Okay, Louise from Standard Chartered Bank. This is a question for Michael. Michael, you mentioned that the outcome of training, making sure that the training that you've conducted is effective and actually monitoring to see if behaviors have changed is very important. So how are you doing that? That behaviors change is difficult to track. So how do you do that?
Yeah, that's evolving. It's a real challenge for us. We use surveys. We use focus groups. We get feedback from third parties. So we get feedback from regulators who come in and have conversations with our traders, or they go into a branch and they mystery shop in branches. There's a whole host of things to do that are designed and look, and you can do some analytics around, you know, how the results have turned out for customers. But again, it goes back to there's no one thing that's going to say, well, there it goes, it worked. We tend to use that in the e-learning space because it goes back to what I said before. Some of the regulators and some of like the DOJ and other settlements, you have to demonstrate that you've delivered training to, you know, 100,000 people. So that's one of the ways to do it. But people can just take that training. It doesn't mean, from my perspective, doesn't mean any change in behavior. So the trick is to use all of our tools. We, you know, internal audit helps us. The risk management of the organization helps us, and we put all of those together. We actually now use, Steve won't like this, we do have a cultural measurement dashboard for the firm that we use at the ExCo level that we've introduced, and we use it at the board level, and it captures quite a bit of these things. And it goes back to, I think, what Javier said, it's a much more holistic view to get a sense for how effective are they. But the proof is in the eating of the pudding, which is, you know, when traders are making decisions, when people are making decisions, are those decisions in line with our values and behaviors? Those values and behaviors yield a culture. You don't just say, I want that culture. You say, these are the values and behaviors that we value, reward. If you don't have them, then you shouldn't work here, and then that yields a culture for you. But it's not there's no panacea, I don't think, Louise.
Okay. And we have another question up back. We've got one down here.
Hi, Paul Butler from Catalyst. Interested to understand the view of the panel about the role of training and education in the annual certification process that's going to be part of senior manager certification regime, and specifically how you might use it to determine whether someone's fit and proper in their role.
Right, so that's training and education in the annual certification scheme. Katie?
Yeah, so speaking again from the point of view of the standards, we've done some work. So for example, I've talked about the foundation standard that's at a fairly basic level. Because your question was specifically about the SMR, what we've done with the leadership standard, so that typically would be aimed at that senior population that would fall into that category. And what we do against those requirements, we would go out and we would benchmark each of the requirements against a firm's systems and processes. So that could be a whole raft of things, if they have specific leadership programs, if they have psychometric testing. And what we've then done is actually cross-reference that to all of the conduct rules, for example, and the additional senior managers regime rules as well. And we've actually developed what we're calling a translation tool, which actually, it's certainly not a tick box. What it is that a firm could talk about how they're meeting the requirements of the leadership standard, and they could actually break it down with a narrative about what they'd be doing in that particular area. And that could be something that could be part of the portfolio of evidence that's presented. We've certainly had conversations with the FCA about how that might work. So I'm not trying to claim that the leadership standard, for example, would cover every element of the senior manager's regime, but certainly it would go a proportion of the way.
Thanks for the question, Paul. I think we would, we're in the process of executing against the program. We've built it into our performance management system and our employee lifecycle. So we've actually made it part of how we evaluate performance, again, aligned to making sure that people understand their responsibilities. You know, we basically are enhancing our current internal system. We didn't build a separate thing. We basically said, you know, we're going to make this, because we went from maybe 1,000 folks to 7,000 folks covered under the regime. So we built it and made it part of our own performance management process. So in fact, there are a couple of things, but it's very much, again, goes back to, there isn't a training component to it. There's the normal curriculum that I talked about for each individual in the firm, and depending upon their job. But the curriculum is not designed to say you're a certified person. It might have an enhancement to your curriculum because you are, and that might include. But it will also, more importantly, include as part of your performance management discussion, aspects and questions to ask around your fit and proper capabilities and how you've interacted and your performance for the year are all connected to that discussion. I don't know if that answers your question.
The thought I would like to add is I see certification as one step, one very strong step towards something that I call expert learning. If we take an analogy, for instance, you can be a certified pilot, but that doesn't make you an excellent pilot. It takes a lot more. It takes, you know, that awareness I referred to before. So certification is a very good step forward, you know, to bring about some of the things that we've been discussing today, but it's just one step.
How do you know someone's a good pilot?
It's a good question. You know when someone is a good pilot, when something happens and he's not containing the standard operating procedures, and yet, you know, they're able to fly the planes. Yeah. And, you know, they're able to fly the planes when all the systems, you know, go bust.
Another question down here?
Hello, Sarah Thomas, Herbert Smith Freehills. I'm interested to know, in implementing training and education for the new SNCR, and in particular on the conduct rules side, which will apply to much larger part of the organisations than previously, have you had any challenges in getting the balance right between asking people to think about the conduct rules and their decision-making versus people getting so anxious about possible consequences or unforeseen consequences of their decision-making that it sort of gums up the business, gums up decision-making and stultifies people's ability to do their job for customers and for the business?
Sure. So, yes, we see that. The again, go back a little bit. There is a, as the regime is rolled out, we have lots of angst in the organization because of quite frankly, some mixed messaging from the regulatory bodies, right? You can hear our supervisors talk about it, but you might hear enforcement have a slightly different slant on it, which makes people quite nervous. Again, it goes back to the idea that Steve raised earlier about building it into your process, right? So the fact of the matter is the overall regime is designed to put a framework around things that were supposed to already exist, right, or should already exist. And that includes, you know, when I have the conversation with senior folks in the organization, I say to them, what, now you're going to focus on your conduct, you know, the five key, you know, key conduct rules. Now you're going to, you know, now you're going to have integrity because there's a rule for it. So I think there has to be balance there, and education, transparency is the way that we've tried to address that. That's, of course, aspirational. We're still working through it. We still have folks who are quite nervous about it, and they have anxiety. But we've historically, over the last, since 2012, we've been pushing out this idea on values and behaviors, and that has been virtually in everything we do. So it's in the performance life cycle of individuals. It's how businesses and individuals get evaluated. It's in their performance objectives. It is how we do business now. We are always going to have problems, but the idea is, do we have a process in place and do we deal with them quickly? The folks that have, there is a gumming up of it, but it started with our the conversation that we had back in 2012. There was a culture of fear in the organization because people were afraid inside the organization. Now there's a slight variation of that, which is outside the organization, and what is that going to mean to me if I decide X and it goes south? And we're trying to put in a process by which that they can, you know, all of these things are complementary. The Barclays, you know, you went through the Barclays lens, you've asked those questions, you've consulted with the right people in the organization, and you've landed on a decision, and the decision went wrong, the company will stand behind you, and we think that if you've taken reasonable steps to do it, we'll be fine. Easy to say, hard to get behavior to change. Behavioral change in at least our organization, we're now in year four into five, and I would say we're a little bit more than 50% done, maybe. I don't think there'll be a done anyway. I don't know if that answers your question, Sarah.
Mm-hmm. I would add that with my educator hat on, anxiety and fear is Steve's learning. So can you reframe positively that adhering to these regulations can actually have the potential to bring more positive customer outcomes and to bring more value to the organization and to reinforce the culture? I would consider using this as an opportunity, not as a threat to individuals. Like, you have to learn. Quite the contrary, there is an opportunity to bring about other more positive outcomes, more fundamental long-term benefits than just the ones from complying with the regulation.
We have used that as a differential as well, right? The idea being, over time, we want to get rid of any bad reputation we had to the point where people will know if they do business with us, if they do business with your organization, they know they're going to get values and behaviors that align with their thinking, that are in their best interest, et cetera, not the firm's.
Yes, I don't have too much to add to that, Sarah. We're also a step removed, I would say. We hear certainly anecdotally from our member firms, so Mike's opinion would certainly be the strongest there. But from our perspective, what we do is we work with the member firms, we look at their systems and processes that are in place, and, for example, the evidence that they're meeting a standard as well. So we're not hearing, I say, directly from the individuals involved, but we hear the anecdotes, and we hope that we're supporting the member firms to support the individuals to meet those requirements.
I have one last question. Thanks.
Thank you. It's Karen Harris-Bush from RBC. Michael, this is for you again. You had mentioned you had trained up some culture champions to go out and spread the word. Is that all from the top, or have you selected people from top, middle, and below?
Everywhere. It doesn't work if it's just the top. Our view was it doesn't work if it was just the top. It was, in fact, we did do a training specific to the top of the house called Moral DNA by Roger Steers. It was one that we used industrial psychologists for it, et cetera. But for the broad training, and we're actually looking at it again to kind of reinvigorate it, it's every level. It's people who had a passion for it, who were good in front of a room just to talk to some folks and tell them about how it works. So it was all at every level in the organization we had folks that were in that role.
Well, I've got a clock here that says zero on it, and it's flashing at me, so I'm unfortunately going to have to finish at that. We'd like to thank the panelists for their very interesting contributions.
Thank you very much indeed. Did you pick up a slight sense that Michael doesn't believe in e-learning? Michael, do you just say very quickly the article that you referred to?
Those ethics trainings your job requires are even dumber than you think. By L.V. Anderson, Slate Magazine, May 2016.
Okay, thanks very much. So I've deliberately steered you away from the outcome of that referendum towards the positive aspects of culture and the things that add business value and enable businesses to achieve long-term success responsibly and sustainably. If I'm going to give you a steer towards the afternoon, I think we're in danger of talking about culture as if it's a British product. We haven't begun to address, you know, culture on an international dimension and which culture is best and how you absorb other cultures. Thank you very much for your attention in the morning. We've now got a lunch break. We reconvene at 5 to 2 on a wheels-off basis. Do you know what a wheels-off basis? Wheels-off is MOD speak for that's when the plane leaves the ground. 5 to 2. Thanks very much.